Hello and welcome aboard. This is lesson number 5, and I'm Dr. Richard Nongard. And in today's lesson, what I'm going to do is I'm going to really focus on three key concepts or three key exercises that apply within the ACT model. The first is an exercise called the willingness dial. The second is an exercise in acceptance. And the third, I'm going to actually share with you two methods of cognitive diffusion. Now, every now and then when I talk about ACT therapy and talk about cognitive diffusion, people wonder if it's diffusion, D-I-F-F-U-S-I-O-N. No, it's diffusion, as in no longer fused with those cognitive thoughts. So the spelling is actually correct in the notes from the ACT therapy vantage point. Now, this lesson is, again, lesson number 5, and it's going to be experiential. To continue further, you really don't want to be in a car. You really want to be in an office, in a chair, or for these exercises, you could actually find a comfortable spot and lay down on the floor if you wanted to. I do these exercises with my clients, of course, in the safety and the comfort of my office, where they're not driving a car, because it is what psychologist Don Gibbons from New Jersey called experiential theater. And this approach is a highly effective approach. In fact, Don Gibbons was the president of the New Jersey chapter of the American Psychological Association. He has published a tremendous amount of research over the last 30 or 40 years. And some of his work on how to apply concepts from psychology into the practice of psychology, I think are really among the best. Now, these exercises are not exercises that Dr. Gibbons actually taught. They're exercises that either come from a strict ACT therapy vantage point, the textbooks related to ACT therapy, or really my own experiences and adaptations of these things with the clients who I work with. Don's idea, though, of experiential theater is the idea of having our clients go through an experience rather than simply talking about the processes of counseling that are going to be useful to them. To a large extent, this is very similar to the process of clinical hypnosis or clinical hypnotherapy. And although I do a fair number of training programs on clinical hypnosis and clinical hypnotherapy, and in my office practice clinical hypnosis, I'm always amazed at how many mental health professionals are unfamiliar with the modality of hypnosis or hypnotherapy. And they even come to my training sometime and they say, I'm not sure I can learn this. All therapists already do hypnosis. It doesn't matter what approach or theoretical orientation you've had to this point, you certainly are using hypnosis. Because of Hollywood, we think of hypnosis as a magical or mystical state, or we see trance as something that only occurs because of an altered state of consciousness. The reality is there's absolutely nothing, zero, that happens in hypnosis or hypnotherapy that doesn't happen in real life. Now, if you've seen a stage hypnotist or some other sort of show or performance like that, recognize that that's theater. That's what Hollywood likes to represent rather than what hypnosis really is all about. And every therapist, whether they've ever taken a hypnosis training course or not, does hypnosis. What do you mean by that, Richard? Well, what I mean is when we have a client who's got chaos and busyness and stress and fusion with their cognitions going on in the outside world, and they make a decision to make a change and they enter into our office. Now, I've been into a lot of therapists' offices, and they're almost always set up sort of like a relaxing living room. You know, you have a comfortable recliner, a comfortable couch, or wingback chairs with big arms to fully sink into. Whether we've ever taken a hypnosis course or not, when we take somebody outside of the busy world and their enmeshment with the difficulties of life, and we bring them into an unrelated, safe environment and have them relax in the nice environment that we've provided for them so that they can truly focus on the change that they need to make, that is, in fact, the essence of the hypnotic process. And we have a client who puts aside so many difficult things to focus in therapy on what it is that we're trying to work with them to resolve. we're actually engaged in a hypnotic process with them. So hypnosis is one of those loaded words that people are often a little mystified by, sometimes even scared of, but the reality is we all experience hypnosis every single day, and we experience trance every single day. In fact, hypnosis or hypnotherapy isn't about getting somebody into hypnosis or getting them into trance. What Hollywood is all about. It's really about helping our clients to utilize the trance states that naturally exist. We have our highway hypnosis, our driving trance. Have you ever watched a movie and you cried? Let's take the movie Marley and Me, for example. You cried at the end when the dog died. They really didn't kill a dog in order to make the movie for your entertainment. No dog actually died during the making of the movie Marley and Me. Interesting, there were actually, I think it was 14 dogs that were used in that movie, and they used a bunch of kids because the kids kept getting older too. So nobody was actually harmed in the movie Marley and Me. No dog was actually killed. But yet you really did cry when you saw that movie. There wasn't a dry eye in the theater when I saw that movie. By the way, if you're upset that I've given away a spoiler, well, it's taken you over 10 years probably 15 years to get to the movie, so I figure if you haven't seen it by now, you're probably not going to see it. That's really an example of hypnosis, or experiential theater, as Don Gibbons calls it, where we have suspended that critical factor of the mind and fully engaged in the experience, in this case of a Hollywood movie, and it produced real emotion. All therapists do this in our office. We engage clients in a process. And so when I use the word hypnosis or use the word hypnotherapy or a hypnotic process, we should recognize that this is something all of us do, even Albert Ellis. In fact, a lot of people forget that Albert Ellis, in his seminal book, Rational Emotive Therapy, which was the basic textbook for cognitive behavioral therapy in the 1970s, another evidence-based treatment protocol, Albert Ellis devoted a whole chapter in that book, Rational Emotive Therapy, specifically to the value of utilizing these trance states. And of course, if anyone studied the work of Milton Erickson, he was a family therapist as well as a psychiatrist who used language patterns to affect change in his clients. And those approaches are certainly hypnotic methods as well. So these three exercises that I'm going to guide you through are experiential processes. I use these with my clients, sometimes in a formal process of hypnosis, but generally without such a formal process. I will be talking to my client, interviewing my client, discussing with them their valued path, discussing with them their thoughts, their feelings, their experiences. I will be training them in the art of mindfulness. And then I might say to them something that begins a process of, in the case of today's lecture, establishing willingness, or moving towards acceptance, or breaking cognitive fusion. So the first exercise is called the willingness dial. And so find a comfortable place, relax, kick back in the chair. You can close your eyes if you want to. You can leave your eyes open. It doesn't make a bit of difference. It feels awesome, though, to earn CEU hours with the eyes closed. So you may as well close the eyes and take in a breath and really become mindfully aware of your presence in this lecture. Remember when you were a kid and you might have had one of those toys called a Chinese finger trap? It was a toy many people played with, and it was made out of straw, and it was braided together, and it was shaped into a tube. And when you put your index fingers of each hands into the ends of the tube, it constricted in such a way that when you tried to pull them out, it created a virtual finger cuff. It became impossible to remove them by pulling them out. The harder you tried to pull them out, the tighter the braids on that straw became. Of course, in order to finally get out of the finger trap, the way to finally free the fingers was to try to stop pulling, to break free, to stop resisting the trap. Counterintuitive, to say the least, which is why the Chinese finger trap toy, when not used as a child's toy, but an ancient torture devices, was so effective. The only way to find freedom from the Chinese finger trap was to let go of the struggle. Years ago, there was a song by a Presbyterian minister named John Fisher, and the lyrics of the song said, "Losing is winning when it turns you around. It all looks clear with your feet on the ground. You walk out a winner." One of the great paradoxes of the mind is that the more we struggle to solve a problem, the more constricting it becomes. And that true freedom often comes from submission. And this, of course, brings up the subject of willingness, and you must ask yourself, how willing am I to stop resisting the struggles? How willing am I to stop resisting depression, anger, anxiety? Willingness to change and commit to a valued direction is really where you are right now. Of course, by being willing to stop the struggle, it doesn't mean that you will lose. To the contrary, it means you'll give up the suffering. And that's where we find freedom. So I'm going to ask you, how willing are you to give up control of your internal thoughts and feelings? How willing are you to just let fear be fear, to let sad be sad, without struggling to stop it, control it, or direct it? Imagine in front of you a dial with one on the low end and 100 on the high end. To what degree, essentially to what number, are you willing to give up control? Think about that number now. To what number on that dial, one at the low end, 100 at the high end, are you willing to give up trying to control your husband, your wife, your anxiety, your fear, your drinking, whatever it is? If you chose a low number, you are holding the idea that a low number means that you'll experience much less pain. But that's, of course, not what experience has taught you. If that were true, the resistance and thought suppression was effective, you wouldn't be here. So consider your score and your willingness to increase the number from a 5 to a 10, from a 10 to a 20, from a 20 to a 40, from a 40 to a 50, even from a 50 to an 80 to 90 or even maybe 100. Being willing to give up trying to control that drinking spouse, fear, depression. And find that when you increase that number, when you increase the acceptance of pain, paradoxically, your suffering can be let go of forever. And so now I'm going to ask you, at what number on a scale of 1 to 10 are you willing to stop resisting and to simply accept? It is at this point, if I'm with a real client, that I'm probably going to be bridging into some real issues for the therapeutic process. This is probably going to be one of those breakthrough points in this particular session where I use a process like the willingness dial. And if your eyes are closed, go ahead, take in a breath. Breathe in, let the oxygen reach every cell of the body and open the eyes. Feeling fantastic because you've learned a process that can be useful not only to you but to your clients as well. Now, because this is one-dimensional, this is a pre-recorded MP3 that you're listening to, I'm not actually interviewing you and talking to you. This script is provided, and I've outlined it almost word for word in the notes, so that you can adapt it to what's appropriate for your clients. I didn't ask you too many questions or get feedback, of course, because you can't talk back to the recording. But you can see how this exercise is a great exercise to help my clients identify what their current level is and what level of willingness they would be able to move for. This is really incremental therapy. Instead of moving from here to here, we're simply moving from here to a willingness to be somewhere else. And that, of course, was the heart of Richard Dreyfuss's book, Baby Steps, in that movie, What About Bob? Some of you are saying, where'd that reference come from? I think every therapist who I've ever met has seen that movie, What About Bob? In that movie, Richard Dreyfuss played a psychiatrist, Bill Murray played his clients, and the fictional book that the psychiatrist Richard Dreyfuss wrote was a book called Baby Steps. It was a great movie. It actually taught something that was actually true, and that is that we don't need to make all of the changes today. Today only requires willingness. When we achieve willingness, we'll move to where we need to be. There are perhaps 1,000 different exercises for acceptance. This next exercise that I'm going to guide you through is simply one exercise that I use with my clients. And so if we're at a point where it's clear that there are issues, there are people, places, things, feelings, sensations, or awarenesses that my client needs to accept, then I might engage in this process with them. And again, some of these things are simply easier to experience and to go through than to explain. And so as I go through this process that you can use with your clients, I'd love for you to actually think of some things that you need to accept in your own life in order to help you move forward. And so, again, find a comfortable chair, probably the same one, the same place. You can leave your eyes open and simply pay attention to the words that I use, or you can close your eyes if you'd like to. Either way is fine. But as you listen, I'm going to guide you through a process of understanding and experiencing acceptance. It uses the imagination. And so imagine that you're in a large conference room. All the chairs surround a large table, and you're sitting in the executive chair at the end. All of the other chairs in the conference room are unoccupied. Imagine you're the only one in the room. A large box sits in the middle of the table. Acceptance, of course, doesn't mean that you like something, nor does it mean that you wish that it would happen again or happen to others. Acceptance really is just about a willingness to see that which has occupied your thoughts, your feelings, your concerns, and to acknowledge the roles that these things have played in your life. The box on the table, of course, holds all of those things that you've not wanted to look at or see. Perhaps because of pain or fear or for any other reason. But not only in the conference center that you've created, but in this actual office here, you are safe. You've come here to move forward. And so this is actually your opportunity. In the safety of this office, to begin unpacking these things from the box and placing them on the table. And so step up to the box and open the box. And by one, unpack those items from the box, looking at them without judgment or attachment. Simply acknowledging what those things are and placing them on the table. See yourself doing this, or hear the sound of those items landing on the desk. Taking each item out and simply placing the items from this box on the table. There may be only one or two things, or maybe five or six things. Maybe there are many things. But when the box is unpacked, look at all of those items. See them. But rather than sitting again, simply stand at the end of the table, taking as much time as you need in silence to simply see those things out on the table. If it's too painful at this point, you can always have a client move into a second perceptual position, stepping out of them, being an observer, maybe from the other side of the glass, seeing them looking at those things on the table. But of course, you're safe. You're the only person in the room observing the table. When you've looked long enough at all of the items on the table, imagine you approach the doorway, leaving those items exposed on the table, not packing them up again. Turn out the light. Walk through the door, closing it behind you. Those things, feelings, and experiences are neither hidden nor neglected, but as you walk out the door and into the light of this new chapter of life, recognize that they were there. And that by living fully in the present, you've developed a sense of acceptance, simply seeing life as it is, and practicing the new art of living fully in the moment. And again, this is an exercise in a class, and it is time, if your eyes are closed, to take in a breath, to reorient yourself to the room, to the chair below you. Even grab a tissue if needed, that's perfectly okay. And to open the eyes, excited about the ability you have now to use a concept like this, an experiential theater like this, to move your clients towards a point of acceptance. This, again, is another exercise that can be used with clients, really in a variety of contexts and situations. It is one of many tools to help us move our clients towards acceptance in ACT therapy. Exercise number three is, before we go into exercise number three, I want to talk about de-literalization. In ACT therapy, this is one technique that I think is particularly useful. And what it is an exercise that is really kind of silly and kind of fun. And what it does is it separates a word from its meaning. And that can be a real powerful tool. There are many different ways in ACT therapy that we can defuse from our unhealthy cognitions. In fact, Stephen Hayes' book, I think every therapist should buy it, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, has a number of great exercises focusing on cognitive diffusion. Indeed, literalization is one of these techniques. Let's suppose, for example, you have a client who's enmeshed with hurt. The pain of the hurt is so deep, they are a hurt person. That is almost at this point their identity. They literally own the word hurt. Happens in couples counseling all the time. Happens when I'm counseling children of alcoholics who are both adults as well as adolescents and even children. Even though you're not my client, I'm going to have you play the role of the client as you listen to this audio. This is actually what I would have my client do, who owns that word hurt, who is in fact hurt, whose identity has become hurt. Their need is to defuse from that word, to put some space between them and that word, because that word has become so powerful to them. You can see the application here, certainly in couples counseling. And the process is silly. It's a process called deliteralization. What you're going to do is you ask the client to say the word that they are fused with out loud, mindfully observing the word, saying it as quickly as they can, but still able to enunciate it and pronounce the word. This process is a silly process, but it's an amazing process because when we give our clients 45 seconds to do this, never less than 45 seconds, never more than 60 seconds, when they're done with the exercise, I ask them if there's any, I ask them really to check to see if by now saying that word, if in any way, shape, or form it feels different than it did a few moments ago. And my client will almost always say yes, having put some space between them and the word. And so, I'm going to ask you to go through this process. We use the example of hurt. And so I'm actually going to time you. You out loud, as you listen to this MP3, so don't worry, nobody can hear you. You're going to say the word hurt as many times as you can, still enunciating clearly, paying attention to the sounds, but doing it quickly for the next 45 seconds. I'm timing you with my watch. Go. Hurt, 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 hurt. Continue to say the word. I know it gets hard to even say the word at this point, but continue to say the word. 15 seconds left. And stop. What happened to the word? What happened to the word hurt? It changed, didn't it? It's really pretty amazing. Taking a breath, breathe in, breathe out. And now say that word just once, hurt. Is there some space between you and the word? Does it feel different now than it did even 30 minutes ago? By the way, try this exercise in deliteralization and couples counseling with the name of the mistress or the mister that's been part of the enmeshment of the wounded or hurt spouse. That is a powerful strategy in couples counseling. The next strategy in cognitive diffusion is really about good therapy. And good therapy is teaching clients skills. And the skill of cognitive diffusion is important. It puts some space between them and a thought or them and a feeling. The script that I'm going to share with you uses both didactic learning and experiential theater. Because when we look at something across the room, there's space between us and the object, it's easy to see it from a number of different perspectives simultaneously. That is not a luxury we have with thoughts and feelings, which are often right on top of us. For example, let's say a newspaper lies on the table across the room from us. We can see the headline. We can tell if a section is missing. We can see if it's a full-size daily paper or a smaller weekly rag. But if you were sitting in a chair and that newspaper were sitting on your head, you could feel it, but you probably couldn't see it in its entirety. It's just too close. I'm going to teach you, you're playing the role of my client here, two techniques that you can practice when you find your thoughts or feelings distressing. During this time, I'm going to teach you each technique. I will also give you time to practice some. Of course, you can practice these things with or without closing your eyes. They're actually skills for you to develop and learn to use intuitively and automatically. The first idea is to remove the power of a thought or emotion by slowing it down, way down. You've said, you feel like you're not a worthwhile person. Usually when you say that to yourself, you just hear that voice in your mind, maybe even screaming it or shouting it at you. But now you're going to practice changing that voice and all of those self-defeating errors and putting some space between you and the thought. Either out loud or in your own mind, say, you are not a worthwhile person. But this time, say it softly and slowly. Not as you usually hear it in your mind. This is a great counter to that self-talk that Albert Ellis talked about. Did you notice you responded to that familiar self-talk a little bit differently by making your voice softer and by slowing it down? Try it again. This time, even slower. Very slowly say, Richard is not a worthwhile person. In fact, say it again, even slower. Almost so slow that it doesn't make sense anymore. Richard is not a worthwhile person. Now ask yourself, when I think this thought, is my experience of this thought different now than it has been in the past? Of course it is, because you've created some space between you and the thought. You've changed the submodalities of it, and you're no longer going to automatically respond to that negative self-talk with impulsive choices, but instead will respond when noting these thoughts by slowing them down and changing the experience of the thoughts. Another idea you can do is to imagine the negative thoughts in your head are being broadcast from a negative news channel. You can imagine that this negative news channel is broadcasting from your mind. It's even okay to have a little bit of fun with this, to even smile as you hear your negative self-talk through the NNC, the negative news channel. Go ahead. Start thinking of what the NNC might broadcast tonight. This is the NNC, negative news channel, broadcasting 24/7, 365 days a year. Today I'm fat, I'm ugly, and I'm a bad person. Go ahead. Identify some of your own negative thoughts and hear them through the voice of the announcer of the NNC. I'm stuck in the situation. I can't do anything right. I'm going to screw up the future. Go ahead. Hear it again. Even in a radio announcer's voice. Listen to the bad news radio. It's absurd, isn't it? See, in the past, you automatically bought into the thoughts that you created. But by creating the absurd NNC, you've heard them played through another person's voice and can now recognize those thoughts as just thoughts, about as meaningless to you as the real nightly news. Now, of course, all of these exercises have to be adapted to your personality, to your particular clients, your particular situation. But like I said, my goal in this course is not just to talk about therapy, but to actually demonstrate for you some of the strategies. These are, of course, demonstrations in a course. But all of these demonstrations in this course have come out of my real work with real clients, the processes that I've used to help them make change. And my hope is that you can find ways to creatively adapt the scripts that I've been provided, that I've provided for you, so that you can benefit the clients who are on your caseload.